Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com. The program you are about to hear was originally presented at the 2006 Miami Book Fair International. Beyond the Book's Christopher Keneally hosts a provocative panel discussion on Family Secrets, Family Truths, American Immigrant Stories. Panelists include Michael Patrick McDonald, author of the new book, Easter Rising, An Irish American Coming Up From Under. Maria Elena Salinas, Univision anchor and author of her memoir, I Am My Father's Daughter, Living a Life Without Secrets. And Sasha Suling Welland, assistant professor of anthropology and author of her critically acclaimed memoir, A Thousand Miles of Dreams.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to a special edition of a program we call Beyond the Book. We're very delighted to be here at the Miami Book Fair on behalf of Copyright Clearance Center. I want to warmly welcome you to this very special program. My name is Christopher Keneally, and we have a terrific discussion ahead of us, I believe. We call it Family Secrets, Family Truths, American Immigrant Stories. And I want to start by reflecting for a moment on secrets. We love to have someone say to us, tell me a secret. And I wondered briefly this morning about the power of secrets. The obvious one, of course, is that they can be juicy. They'll be a little tidbit of forbidden information. And those kind of secrets are really the fun ones. The ones that are the most powerful are the ones that have a power to disturb a balance that's been set up. And we uncover something that's been hidden for a long time, something perhaps even hidden in plain view. It disturbs the stories we've already told us, and we need to rearrange the way we see our lives. And that is the subject, really, for each of the books that we're going to discuss today with their authors. What happens when you uncover the secret? And I want us to think about it from their story viewpoint, but also what this means at various levels. At the national level, at the cultural level, at the business level. When secrets are uncovered, governments can fall. Corporations will go into bankruptcy. But it's interesting to me that in families, sometimes the discovery of secrets can actually strengthen them. So again, welcome to this program for Beyond the Book. I want to start with Maria Elena Salinas, who is the author of I Am My Father's Daughter, Living a Life Without Secrets. She delivers the evening news to millions of television viewers 5 nights a week on the Univision television network, the number one Spanish language network in the United States. She has been called by the New York Times the voice of Hispanic America, and she is unquestionably the most recognized Hispanic female journalist in this country. Welcome, Maria Elena.
Thank you so much.
It's appropriate for a discussion about family secrets that, of course, your book is subtitled Living a Life Without Secrets. In some ways, that's an ambition a lot of us share, but up to a point. And I guess I want to ask you about how you feel the secrets that your father kept throughout his life in your family affected you. I suppose you have to start by telling us what that secret was.
I have to give away my secrets so early on. Basically, the book is about a lot of different things. It's not only about family secrets, but I realized as time went on and as I learned more about my father's past that the book sort of had to revolve around my father's secret because it had so much impact in my life. And upon finding out my father's secret, I learned not only about him and his past, but I learned a lot about myself. When my father passed away in 1985, a friend of his came over to the station where I was working, Channel 34, and he in Los Angeles, which is the Univision affiliate there in L.A., and told me that my father had given him a box of, not a box of secrets, I call it a box of secrets, a box of documents. It had books, it had letters, files, receipts, a lot of different things that, according to my father's friend, my father had asked them just to save it for him, just to keep it in a safe place. Our birth certificates were there. A lot of things from our childhood were there. When I took that home and started looking through each and every piece of paper that was there, I found a small pamphlet. And in the pamphlet, it was the 25th anniversary of my uncle's priesthood. I knew that he had been, that my uncle had been a priest, and I began to read it. And there was a part where it said, "I am thankful for those who influenced my vocation as a priest, including my brother, Reverend José Luis Cordero Salinas." And I said, "Reverend José Luis Cordero Salinas, that's my father. What does he mean by reverend?" And I ran to ask my mother, who was crying because my father had just passed away a few days before. And she said, "I don't know anything. The only thing I know is that when I met your father, he told me he had been involved with the church and had been very disappointed, had had a very disappointing experience that drew him away from the church." At that moment, her suffering was such that I didn't really want to dig more into the secret. But it really, all of a sudden, changed my whole perspective on what my life had been like. I grew up in a bilingual, bicultural family, and in this type of environment, always thinking that my life was like a novella, you know, where the well-to-do man marries a very poor, beautiful, but very poor, uneducated young woman and is disowned by the family, because we didn't really know my father's family. So finding this out made me realize that maybe the reason why we didn't know my father's family, we're not close to my father's family, had more to do with the fact that he had been a priest than the fact that he had married someone who was not at his level. My father had spoke six languages. My father had a doctorate degree in philosophy, and my mother had only a sixth grade grammar school education. So that was the first impact that it made in my life. Everything that I grew up thinking was not the way that I had envisioned it. And I think from that point on, my mother and I became so much closer. My mother began to tell me a lot about her past. I became her confidant. And I realized then that what my father's secret did was build a sort of an invisible barrier that didn't allow us to be closer, that didn't allow the flow of communication between us, so that we knew more about our history and we knew more about our past. So I think that that's one of the main ways that that it impacted my life, in looking at my entire life up to that point in a completely different light.
When you discovered the secret, did you resent that he had kept this information? How did you feel emotionally about it? I mean, obviously there was a curiosity about what, you know, the details behind it all, but it had an emotional impact, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, being a reporter, of course, I embarked in a journalistic investigation of my own past. Definitely the toughest assignment that I have had in my career. But I don't think that there was a resentment. Of course, I wish that he would have told us. I tried to understand why. But before that, I had to know the facts. And I had to dig into the past. And I had to try to find his family. And I met his family in the strangest ways. Sometimes while I was on assignment, I met someone who happened to be a cousin of mine that I didn't even know existed. And I found out that not only that I not know they existed, they didn't know we existed, because when my father disappeared, he did not tell them that he was going off to get married.
Well, right, so there's a kind of a duality to the secret. Yeah. There was a secret on one side of the border, and this is fascinating to me. There was a secret on this side of the border, and at the same time, there was a different secret on the other side, back in Mexico.
Yeah, and those were really life-altering decisions that he made. And, you know, you have to respect the fact that he didn't want to share that information. And I think, because knowing that my father was so Catholic and, you know, so religious, and to him it was so important for us to have, you know, a moral education and a Catholic upbringing, that it would have created for little girls a lot of confusion. A lot of confusion about religion, a lot of confusion about family. How is it possible that if he had been a priest, that he was married? And why would he would have to explain to us why he left the church? I didn't realize this until many years later, but I still don't know for sure, but I don't think my parents ever got married by the church. It's something that it never occurred to me. Now that I think about it, I say, you know, I don't remember seeing wedding pictures. Hmm. But I never asked for them. I didn't realize that I hadn't seen them until I found out. But I don't think that it was a resentment. I think I had just too much respect for my father. As a person, he was a very decent person to be angry at him for not telling us those secrets.
And you already mentioned it, but you know, your career as a journalist has been about informing people, working hard at being fair and balanced in the presentation of a story. And I wonder how difficult it was for you as the writer of this memoir to be fair about your own life, to be honest about your own life.
Truly fair and balanced. That's
I heard that phrase.
Truly
come out
fair and balanced, and that one's not a cliche.
That's been
like
co-opted, I suppose.
But, yes, it has been.
Which is unfortunate, but I think you know what I'm trying to say.
Right. Uh-huh.
The book has its journalistic elements, but it's still a memoir, and I wanted you to tell us how it was to sit down and write it entirely as a personal narrative rather than as one that was entirely a public one.
Well, you know, the first thing that you think about is not only yourself and your own life and the things that you want to share about your life. I mean, this is not a confession. It's not a deposition where you have to tell every single fact about your life, everything that you have felt, everything that you have ever thought. It's about what you think, what part of your life you think is a story that's worth telling. I think the difficult part was telling someone else's secrets without them being there to authorize it or to to approve it and to say it's okay. Not only my father wasn't around, but my mother also passed away 8 years ago. And even when she was alive, she really couldn't make that decision because she had suffered a stroke several years before and was not able really to, was not all there mentally because of her stroke. So I think that one of the things that delayed the process of writing my book was the fact that I just was not 100% convinced that I had the right to tell my father's secret and to tell my mother's secret. And then I guess with time, I realized that story would help in one way or another, the reader, to understand just how much these secrets affect the family. Because I truly believe, and I'm sure that the other authors that are here today believe that there's no one that doesn't have a secret in their past. Everyone has some kind of secret, whether it's your own secret, your grandparents' secret, your mother's secret, your father's secret, and someone in your family. And it really can change a family life. And why should the person that is holding that secret be carrying that burden with them for the rest of their life when they can share it with their own family members who understand, who care about you, and who will help you carry that burden? What I felt when you asked me before about whether or not I had resentment toward my father, actually I had a lot of more compassion toward him after finding out his secret, realizing how much he must have suffered carrying that secret and not being able to share that with us.
Well, that's a good point. The notion of sharing secrets, particularly within the family, is a constructive activity. As I was saying at the opening, that often secrets can really disturb the balance in a structure, whether it's a family or a government or a business. But you're arguing that by sharing secrets in the family, it makes the family stronger.
I definitely think it does. I mean, I'm sure that there's people that might think differently, but I have to tell you that since my book has been out, I have received calls, letters, emails, comments from people that have had certain family secrets that because they read it in my book decided that maybe it was time either for them to try to ask their parents about things that they doubted or share with their children or share with the rest of their family secrets that they held. And it's sort of it's a release. I mean, I have to be honest with you. After writing this book, I felt like I just got a big load off my shoulders. I felt that it was something that I needed to do. It was almost therapy. It was almost therapeutic to be able to tell this story. And the part of the book, or the part of the title that says, which is the second title, Living a Life Without Secrets, is more the way that I want to live my life with my children. It doesn't mean that I want to be an open book to society. You know, what do people care about my life? My life is important to me and my kids, but everybody's life is important to them as individuals. This is something that I wanted to do for my children, because when it's age appropriate, I think we should share things with them, and I wanted them to know about their background.
At the same time, though, you're a public figure seen nightly on the news, and people identify you with a particular kind of immigrant story, mm-hmm. if I can say that, a success story, really. And I wonder at the same time whether, as we tell ourselves those kind of classic immigrant success stories in this country, whether that requires, whether you think it requires hiding things. Is it necessary for whatever the community is to put something behind it in order to move forward?
I don't think it's necessary, but I know a lot of people make that choice. A lot of people decide that they want to move from one country to another, and they just want to leave their life behind mm-hmm. and start a brand new life. I don't think it's necessary for you to share that with society. I do think that you should consider sharing it with your family members. But I don't think it's necessary to share it with society. Now, why did I don't have anything to hide. I don't have anything in my past, my parents' past, that I am ashamed of, or I don't believe that I have anything to hide. So I had no problem with sharing the story. Besides, I think that there's an element to my life that I think a lot of immigrants will identify with. I am the daughter of Mexican immigrants. My parents arrived here in the 40s. My father lived most of his life without legal documents. And I knew that because I knew that eventually my sisters and I, as American citizens, we were born in this country, did do all the legal process so that my father could have his green card and eventually go back to Mexico and be able to see his family. That was later in his life. He once told us, please help me with this because I want to see my family before I die. He was already ill at that time. But what I found out is the reason why my father was living without documents. And it has a lot to do with the fact that when he arrived here in the 40s, he was immediately, the moment he came in and registered in the city of Los Angeles as a resident there, and he had a visa to be able to come to live in this country, he was recruited because we were in the middle of a war. And my father did not want to go to war. He said, I am a man of peace. I understand in his writings, which are in the book, his very long explanation, his long letters to the Department of War at the time and later to the Department of State, explaining the reasons why he didn't believe that he should. The moral reasons, the legal reasons, why he should not go. So there was another life-altering decision that he had to make. I mean, I understand. I mean, it took me a long time to write my book, and one of the reasons was because I didn't want this to be a book that would put my father in the light of someone who was a draft dodger and an undocumented immigrant, especially in the environment that we have been living in the last few years, because that's not what my father's life was, a lot more meaningful than that. And I think by sharing this, it's an example of how every immigrant, whether they have legal documents or not, has a story behind them, a very individual story, a very personal story. And you can't just lump them all together. You have to look at each person as an individual and understand, you know, what the circumstances in their life were that led them to become undocumented. And I think that by sharing that part of the story, it's something that would help those who want to know more about immigrants understand us a little bit better, and those who are immigrants to be able to identify.
Well, and not only that, but to be able to recover their past and maintain their identity. You don't have to give up your identity. Crossing the border isn't mm-hmm. an experience that makes you lose something. In fact, you should gain, and so should the country in a fashion, rather than having to erase that past. You take it back. You control it. Does that seem reasonable to you?
Well, yeah, but again, I think that it's each person's very personal decision whether or not they want to share their entire past and their entire life with society, but I think that they bring their life's experiences, which is something very valuable, into the society, into their family life, into their community, and that can have a lot of value. Whether it's good or bad, because we learn from our good experiences and we learn from our bad experiences. We learn from, you know, the bad decisions that we make in life and from the good ones. So.
Well, thank you very much, Maria Elena Salinas. Thank you. I want to turn now to Michael Patrick McDonald. He's the author of the new book just published called Easter Rising, An Irish-American Coming Up From Under, as well as the best-selling All Souls, A Family Story from Southie. Michael is currently writing the screenplay for All Souls under an option agreement with Crossroads Entertainment, with Ron Shelton scheduled to direct the movie. Want to welcome from New York, Michael Patrick McDonald.
Thanks. From Boston.
From Boston.
Still cold.
Living in New York.
Living in New York, but always from Boston. Well, I'm from Boston, too. It's hard to tell, but I am. Well, Michael, your books are a fascinating account of your life and the kinds of things that happen in your book, the All Souls at least, mm-hmm. are so gut-wrenching. They seem to be almost out of Hollywood, so it's not surprising you're writing the screenplay. It must have been a tremendous struggle to tell that story. Can you talk to us about the struggle as an author to really honestly recount your family's life?
Well, with All Souls, it was just between me and the material that I was writing. I didn't think any more than just my friends were going to read that book. I didn't think that it was going to grow as much as it did. And so I wasn't writing it thinking, you know, of how many people would read it, which was really helpful. So I was able to just, you know, bear witness to the things that happened, not only in my family, but in the neighborhood of South Boston growing up. Throughout the 70s and 80s in what was the highest concentration of white poverty in America, in South Boston's lower end, in the housing projects, all Irish housing projects, and all the deaths that were a result of organized crime, which is really, I mean, any of the secrets, the hidden truths that I was bringing out were really around some of the communal code of silence stuff, some of the, all the deaths that happened over the years that we didn't talk about within the community, and also the bigger world beyond Southie didn't know about or acknowledge or whatever.
For those who aren't familiar with the book and don't recognize immediately that phrase, code of silence, mm-hmm. tell us about that. What did that mean in South Boston?
Well, in my neighborhood growing up, it was there were a number of code of silences, and I think that that's one of the themes we're talking about here today, really. But within the community, there was the poverty rate and. It was a community of housing projects and single-parent, female-headed households in the lower end of South Boston, anyway. And the poverty rate wasn't something that people even acknowledged. And, part of that has to do with it being a white, poor neighborhood. People just want to, you know, kind of go with the white thing and not not mention any of that bad stuff. But that's perceived as, you know, oppressed and a group that's not part of the mainstream. In a way, and there's all the codes of silence around that, around the poverty and around the violence that happened. But the neighborhood was controlled by the Irish Mafia, organized crime, and Whitey Bulger, who was the neighborhood drug lord, basically that flooded the streets throughout the 70s and 80s with everything from angel dust to cocaine. That controlled all of the illegitimate aspects of the neighborhood, while politicians that he was very closely connected to, and in some cases related. To controlled all the legitimate aspects of the neighborhood, and so there were codes of silence around the violence that happened, the amount of crime that a lot of young people were being recruited into, and basically the drugs in the streets. So every time people died, it was just kind of like nobody really talked about how they died, and they didn't really get mentioned much again. And so in my own family, growing up here, I lost three siblings violently, but the two of them were to the streets. And each time any of those things happened, you just were kind of expected to kind of keep it quiet, go on with your life, and never talk about this stuff. And in years later, as an adult, when I became a community organizer, I had to work on these issues. I had to work on violence and crime and young deaths in poor neighborhoods. All the issues that affected my life I had to work on, but in order to work on that, I had to go to black and Latino neighborhoods across the city, because it's only in black and Latino neighborhoods in Boston that people were talking about these issues, that were admitting oppression and poverty and violence and drugs. And so I had to go over there to other parts of the city of Boston to work with other survivors of crime and the drug trade, because in South Boston we pretended this stuff doesn't happen here. This stuff happens over there. Eventually I brought it back home, but in the beginning that was where I learned all of my activism and community organizing work.
And if I may say, as a Keneally to a McDonald, there's something Irish about that, too.
Yeah, there's the code of silence that's maintained by organized crime, but there's also a willingness to abide by it that really, is among a lot of ethnic groups, but the Irish are known for, not wanting to air dirty laundry, basically.
Well, yeah, there's a line from a Seamus Heaney poem, whatever you say, say nothing.
Right, right.
And that reflects, I think, that power of that code of silence.
And that's something that exists in Ireland, but it even exists even more powerfully in this country because of the immigrant experience. So I think a lot of ethnic groups, a lot of immigrant groups can relate to that as well, because in this country it is kind of about forgetting about where you come from, erasing all of that oppression and all of that history of colonization and otherness, and just trying to slip into the mainstream here.
Right. Tell us about the relationship between the two books and how they, I believe, interlock, where All Souls leads off and how it was written, and where Easter Rising kind of takes up the story and also right. amplifies your piece of it.
Well, the two books aren't really sequential. It's All Souls is more a bearing witness to all of the tragedies that happened, all of the young deaths that happened in my own family and in the community. And so it's a real straightforward bearing witness to all of that stuff. And the tragedies, all of the young deaths and the crime and violence. There's one chapter where my sister's in a coma after she was pushed off the roof in a fight over pills. And while she was in a coma, I'm writing about all the people that were coming to visit her. And writing the book, I realized, all these people are dead too. So I was able to also flash forward to how these people eventually found their demise. And then, it's through the process of writing the book that I really realized the level of atrocity that had happened in the neighborhood. And the atrocities are really at the forefront in this book, in All Souls. And I'm kind of recessed and a kid that's really the eyes watching all of this and bearing witness to it. Whereas Easter Rising, I'm in the foreground as a teenager that's coming into my own. And the tragedies are in the background. So all of the tragedies that happened in All Souls are happening in Easter Rising, but they're in the background. In Easter Rising, I'm more in the round, a fully developed character. Part of it's because it's more about my teenage years, which were years of rebellion and finding your identity and kind of coming into adulthood.
Right, and what's fascinating, because in Easter Rising it does concentrate, not entirely, but concentrates on your life from 13 to 18.
Yeah.
And as you say, that's a period of rebellion, classically. But you were rebelling against something in a very unusual way. I mean, your sense of normal, or the normal that surrounded you,
right.
was so dysfunctional. You went from that to something else. Tell us about that.
Well, after All Souls, when people would read all of the tragedies that existed in the neighborhood and all the ways that young people died, the main question I received from people was, how did you get out? How are you alive? How did you survive? How do you continue to survive? What is it that, the whole resiliency factor? And I wanted to answer that as honestly as I could. And, for the most part, I would get the question from educators and guidance counselors who really wanted me to list an academic career that got me up and out of the neighborhood. And it really wasn't. It really started with, at the age of 13, I was really fortunate to stumble upon the whole underground music scene in Boston, the whole rebellious punk rock scene of the late 70s and early 80s. And that really saved my life at that point of my life, because it was a world, that subculture, at the time, back then, before it became a kind of genre and a kind of conform, another thing to conform to, that subculture, like all subcultures that have happened since World War II, like the hippies and everything else, it was a subculture that encouraged individualization and self-determination. And for me, finding that world was a blessing, because it was a world where you were allowed to to reinvent who you might become, to reimagine who you might become, and to reinvent yourself. And with that came a rejection of all that I came from, everything that I came from, the neighborhood that I came from, all of the crime, the violence, the bigotry that existed in the neighborhood. There was a lot of racism in the years after busing in Boston. And the kind of closed-mindedness of the neighborhood is a very closed place at this time. And so I rejected all of that. So in the whole punk rock music scene, you were rejecting whatever you considered normal. You know, normal was bad. And to me, where I was coming from, normal meant doing coke and engaging in racist conversation and fear of the outside world and a very kind of closed-mindedness toward all people who were different. There was a conformity to the neighborhood. It was a poor neighborhood, and it was a housing project, but there was a conformity in terms of the way you dressed, the ideas you talked about, and nobody would want to step outside of those boundaries and question any of the conversation that was happening, that often was promoted by the gangster ascendancy and the political ascendancy in the neighborhood, that promoted the idea that the outside world is a big, scary place, that black people are scary, that Latinos are scary, that you know, that all that stuff is, we want to keep all of that world out. And as a result, the young people in the neighborhood died in numbers higher than any other neighborhood.
In droves, nearly. there's an appearance several times in Easter Rising by one of the great nonconformists. I just want to bring him up, and maybe you can tell briefly about Johnny Rotten. Yeah. Johnny Rotten is somebody you've sort of idolized, I would say. Is that right?
Yeah, when I was 14, when he first came to town, to Boston, I was hooking school to find him and his new band, Public Image Limited. And
interestingly, he had changed his name at that point to Johnny Lydon,
yeah,
which is another Irish name.
Back to his original name. Actually, a lot of what I was really focused on this music scene that was happening in London and finding out about everything I could about all these people that were at the center of it. And the more, you know, I would often kind of, you would get hints that a lot of these people were actually in London that were creating this new musical scene were all the children of immigrants in London. Whether they were of Somali background or Irish, most of them were Irish background. They were immigrants, often living in housing projects and housing estates in London. And you would get hints of that, but they were also reinventing themselves. So you were really more focused on their whole reinvented person. And that's what I was engaged in doing too. So I didn't pay much attention to that Irish stuff. Part of what I was rejecting, in rejecting everything about where I come from, about South Boston, I was also rejecting all of the heritage stuff, all of the celebrations of Irishness in the neighborhood. It's where the St. Patrick's Day parade happens in South Boston. And so all the kind of green plastic shamrocks and leprechauns and happy-go-lucky songs, I wanted nothing to do with any of that. And this, coming from a family that was, I'm the next generation. It's my grandparents that all came from Ireland. And my mother's a traditional Irish musician on the accordion. So it was a very Irish household, and I was rejecting all of it because, to me, it all represented this kind of closeness that I wanted nothing to do with, this kind of closed identification. I wanted to be part of the bigger world. It represented a lot of the bigotry that I knew in the neighborhood and just a lot of the kind of silly ersatz celebrations of being Irish, and I just rejected every little bit of it and wanted to kind of determine who I might be in the world.
And yet, interestingly, the Easter Rising narrative goes from Boston to New York and then ultimately to Ireland.
Yeah, the last place in the world I thought I'd...
Right, the last place in the world you thought you would be, and yet it's there that you make this really important discovery. Tell us about that.
Well, I had rejected all things Irish. By the time I was 19, I tell the story in Easter Rising of going to Europe after saving money, washing dishes. I bought a plane ticket. Back then, the plane tickets to London were $250 round trip, and then I saved enough money to take a flight, and also I saved $400 for spending. And this was for a 6-week trip, you know. So I went to Europe on $400, and actually, this is mid-80s, and that did actually last 4 weeks. But I'd ran out of money. At one point, I had to call home. My mother had no money. We were on welfare in the housing projects, and I called my grandfather, who's from Ireland, and I asked him if I could borrow $200. And I had been to every single European country and except for Ireland. And I didn't even think of going. I wanted nothing to do at that place. I figured it was everything that I had ever rejected in my life and wanted nothing to do with it, that it was probably just one big Southie and that it was probably as closed as Southie. and so I wanted nothing to do with Ireland. But he said my grandfather said he would lend me $200, but only if I go to Ireland. And I was in London at the time, and London was my Mecca. And this, for an Irish-American kid, even that's culturally, that's just, you know, you don't mention that stuff at home. But that's where the music was happening from. And Paris was another Mecca of mine. Ireland was not my Mecca. It became my Mecca when I went there. And because when I went to Ireland, I figured I'd go for a day and get the heck out and just tell them I went and get the $200. So I went there, and from the start, it just, I sensed that, it all started to make sense. Everything that I'd ever experienced in my life, everything about my family, the community I come from, about myself, started to kind of click. And it began with just seeing the familiar faces walking down the street. You see your grandmother walking by, your grandmother selling fruit and your grandmother buying fruit and, your grandmother's head on a guy driving by in a tractor. And, it's just that immediate identification was just kind of mind-blowing. And then the conversations with people and starting to learn more about the history of the place and the consciousness of the place and how it's all shaped by the experience of colonization. And that really helped me. That eventually became the context from which I understand everything about my family, about my neighborhood, and about myself. The whole history of Ireland, the history, culture, and politics of Ireland, to this day really shape, it's kind of the lens through which I see the world. And it's a history of colonization. And that's another, it's not a secret, but it's something we kind of buried. It's a hidden truth. The Irish are the only white people who were colonized, and they were the first British colony, and they're the only colony that hasn't been let go of. And so that history has shaped everything about the people, all the best and worst aspects of the neighborhood that I grew up in really come from that history, I believe. And so my goal then, from the age of 18, was to find out more about it. Not only to find out more about my family and all the things that led to the tragedies in the neighborhood and in my family, but to find out about my bigger family, about the Irish, because it's not as simple as just being white, and I wanted to go beyond that.
As a last question, I want to ask you about, your career has been as a memoirist, and so therefore your subject is memory. Many of these memories must be very painful. Do you ever wish sometimes that you could get those memories erased or anything like that? Do you ever want them gone?
I never really wanted to erase anything. I just wanted, any time I started to delve into the story, I wanted to go deeper and deeper into it. And it is painful, but I also know from my first experiences with storytelling from the family, that there's an incredible liberation that comes from it, and there's an incredible peace that comes with it. I first started getting involved in telling the stories from my family and from my neighborhood as an activist. I would be part of a citywide coalition of survivors of murder, of the drug trade throughout the neighborhoods of Boston. A lot of parents of murdered children. People would hold press conferences. I was one of the organizers of all this stuff when we would do gun buyback programs. You would have the survivors, a lot of the mothers of murdered children, get up and speak and tell the stories of their children and about the loss of their child. And you saw the transformation that happened in these people when they told their story. And the empowerment that came with it. And you just saw it in their faces. You saw that transformation happen. And I was really interested in that and how that happens. I initially started to, at first I was organizing all these other people telling the truth and telling about what happened in their families and in their communities. And I was the one calling them up and making sure they were going to be at the press conference and, to get to do a gun buyback program or something. And then for once, I got up and started to tell little bits of my own family story and my own experiences with crime and violence and poverty in Southie. And I started to feel that transformation myself. And every time I would tell the story, I would go deeper and deeper. And really, with All Souls and then Easter Rising, I just, these are just attempts to go a little bit deeper. All Souls was an attempt to go deeper into this truth-telling. And then Easter Rising was an attempt to go even deeper than All Souls.
Michael Patrick McDonald, thank you very much.
Thanks.
I want to turn. Finally, on the panel, I want to turn to Sasha Suling Welland, who is an assistant professor of anthropology and women's studies at the University of Washington. Welcome, Sasha. Her memoir, the critically acclaimed 1,000 Miles of Dreams, recounts what we think of as an evocative and intimate tale of two Chinese sisters who took very different paths in their quest to be independent women. And one of those sisters was your grandmother,
yes,
who just recently passed away at 102.
Yeah.
In fact, a week ago.
Yeah.
And so, remarkably, her life spanned the 20th century. And as you tell her story and her sister's story, it's a way in so many ways. It's a way into Chinese history, their own personal histories, her life as a child in pre-revolutionary China, her life as a grandmother, recounting her roots story to you as a young student who did not even speak Chinese at that point. Peel that onion back for us and sketch for us what were the critical moments in her life and for you as you came across them.
Yeah, my grandmother and her sister, my great aunt, lived quite long lives. Her sister lived to 90 and she lived to 102. And so part of me trying to figure out who they were really required me to get a new education in 20th century history, because they had lived through an incredible amount, both in China and then through immigration. My grandmother ended up in the United States, and her sister much later. My grandmother left in the 20s and came to the U.S. at that point. Her sister left in the late 40s for England. There's so many different people in so many different parts of their lives. So, you know, some of the stories that I are really emblematic to me about my grandmother as a young child, she was the youngest of many, many siblings. It's not even entirely clear to me how many children were in the family. She was probably somewhere between the 10th and the 14th child in the family. There were also, it's not clear how many sons were in the family. I think there were very few, if any, that survived. And so as the youngest daughter, I think her father at that time had given up on having an illustrious line of sons. And so his youngest daughters, my grandmother and her sister, he sort of invested in their education, somewhat the way he might have if he'd had a son. And so my grandmother, she was very rebellious. I mean, the way she tells her stories of herself is she's always sort of this rebellious, mischievous hero of them. So as a young child, she claims to have always dressed as a boy, and this is what allowed her to take trips with her father, ride a horse, ride a bicycle, play basketball, play tennis, all of these things that you don't really associate with a woman from a relatively traditional family at the very beginning of the 20th century in China. This led into her, it was all a part of a moment of sort of social unrest at that time. Both of the sisters were part of what I like to call the early women's movement in China in the 20s and 30s. And, you know, when I tell anyone in a lot of people in the United States that there was a women's movement in the teens and the 20s in China, they're sort of flabbergasted by that. So my grandmother, you know, this sort of rebelliousness as a young child of wearing boys' clothes and riding horses, fed into her deep desire at that time to become a doctor. And this was also part of a larger national rhetoric at the time. It was also a place that had been colonized in a process that's often referred to as semi-colonization, because there were many different countries that were had treaty ports up and down the east coast of China at that time. Different Western powers, the Japanese, were also encroaching at that time. And so part of the dialogue at that time is, what's going to save the nation? How are we going to be able to recover the nation? And one of the stories that was really, I think, quite inspiring to many young people at that time was, you will save the nation literally by improving people's health. And so she wanted to become a doctor. There was a story of this is in the early 20s. And the thing that was amazing when I went and did the research back is that there were Chinese women doctors studying in the United States in the late 1800s. So there were role models for her already. There's this woman, Dr. Ding, who had gone to the University of Michigan, gotten a medical degree, and come back to China to open a women's clinic. And I actually just got an email from her great niece, who read my book and told me more of the story about Dr. Ding, was that she actually went back, opened this clinic for rich women, and then was using that to fund a clinic for poor women. So this was my grandmother's role model. of her quest to become a doctor, which is how she ended up getting one of these national scholarships at that time. The year that she came, 1925, there were only five of them for women. And so she came on a boat with many other students, most of them men, and ended up in Cleveland. I guess, you know, peeling back more of the onion is
It goes on and on.
Yeah.
There's one critical moment in that onion peeling that happens when you trace back to your great aunt's life and what you discover was kept from the family in America about her. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was lucky as a college student to, well, first I was sort of lost. I had grown up mixed race, Chinese American in Missouri, and ended up going to college in California, where there was a much greater awareness of Asian American politics and discussion at that time. And so I had done this long oral history with my grandmother at that time, sort of shocked that her stories of, you know, being involved in student protests, demanding an education, helping her classmates unbind their feet. You know, this was sort of, it didn't jive with the stories that I had gotten about Asian American passive women in need of rescue, which is sort of the Hollywood story. So I had done this long oral history to try to figure out who was this woman that I, you know, doesn't match all of the stereotypes that I've grown up with. And as part of that, I ended up going to England to meet her sister's daughter. And at that time, I was given a book by my great aunt's daughter, and she gave it to me. It was a memoir written in English by her mother, and she gave this book to me and said, "Don't ever tell your grandmother I gave you this. We'd never hear the end of it." And it turned out that my great aunt was actually, also as part of this early women's movement, was one of the early women in China to be writing. She was a short story writer and was a published writer.
And a very well-received one, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there was this whole generation of young women who really burst onto the literary scene in the 20s, many of them writing highly semi-autobiographical stories to try to make sense of this moment of transition between tradition and modernity. And the shock of it was that my grandmother had edited her family so that, you know, she had a nuclear family in China, was what I knew of her family tree. She had one father and one mother and three sisters, maybe a brother, an indeterminate number of cousins. Her sister's book, which...
And it's written in English, which is important to you.
In English, because I couldn't read Chinese at that point. So it was something she had written trying to survive in England once she arrived there and continue her career as a writer. And her family tree in the beginning of this memoir has six mothers, one father, and somewhere between 12 and 14 children. And so it turned out that, well, it's not clear to me how many wives or concubines their father had, probably in an attempt to have a son. And the reason it's not clear to me how many there were is because my grandmother had edited it down to one mother, because that is what I think she believed would be acceptable in the United States, since she wouldn't be judged as coming from sort of some backward place. But her sister might have actually exaggerated the number of mothers that were in the family, because she was a fiction writer, and part of her trajectory as a fiction writer was writing a kind of fiction to expose the difficult things that had gone on for women on this type of marriage system. And her memoir, I learned Chinese so I could go back and read her stories that she had written in Chinese. Many of the chapters in the memoir are actually direct translations from Chinese into English, from third person into first person, from fiction into nonfiction. So it's her short stories that were once published as fiction, several of them that end up as chapters in her memoir. So, you know, she may have, for dramatic effect, exaggerated the number of wives or concubines that were in the family.
And that process, as you said, of your grandmother editing her life and remaking her identity, she remade her sister's identity so that her sister was identified to your family as an artist, and there was no information about her career, her long career as a writer.
Yeah, I always grew up thinking she was a painter, and, you know, she did paint, but she was really known as a writer, and I think my grandmother just didn't like what she wrote, and I think they were also very competitive. They were the two youngest daughters who were sort of striving to make themselves into modern women, and this divide of what's going to save the nation, the debate, was it science or was it culture and literature. And so they kind of straddled this divide, and that's the direction that her sister went in. And I think she was jealous also that her sister had had this kind of fame as a very young woman in her 20s in China.
As you worked on the book, which took you something like 15 years, you told me how you would uncover a new piece of information, a new secret, if you will, and that meant you had to reevaluate everything you had already learned. Maria Elena Salinas mentioned the same kind of thing happening to her. What was that like? It must have been frustrating and at the same time really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were sort of multiple secrets. One is the American, you know, Asian American story secret that, you know, everybody knows that it's not true, but there's these persistent stereotypes that, you know, Asian American women are passive and weak and all of this. So that was the first, you know, exciting discovery that, you know, in fact, you know, my grandmother and her sister were nothing like these stereotypes. So that was what really drove me then to uncover more. And then I found out that the two sisters have incredibly different versions of the past. I don't know which of the two, you know, are true. And then I felt a little bit, I felt both confused and sort of betrayed and, you know, didn't know if they had both just been great storytellers and made up everything. So wanted to go further and further into figuring out, you know, the truth of the editing of what they did is they edited themselves according to who they wanted to be at that time and also the constraints of what society was putting on them in order for them to push those stories further. I guess one of the biggest pieces of information that was unsettled everything and took me years and years and years to figure out how to write about is that I discovered a big family secret was that my great aunt, who was married at the time, was living, it was during the war, and so they had sort of fled to Wuhan in the southwest of the country, that she was next door neighbors at that time at a university called Wuhan University to a man named Julian Bell, who was Virginia Woolf's nephew, who had gone, had not lived up to the Bloomsbury group and had gone to teach English in China. And my great aunt had had apparently a very scandalous affair with him at the time, which in some ways explained how she ended up publishing that memoir in England many years later because of the connections through the Bloomsbury group to the Hogarth Press. And, you know, that was something for a Chinese woman at that time to have had an affair with a British man at this time of, you know, trying to free the nation of colonialism, you know, let alone the fact that she was married and had a child at the time was really something that had been kept a big secret. But it's there in letters and archives and sort of things that you can't quite make sense of the story of how she ended up having these connections to the Bloomsbury group without that. And so you know, I did all of this sort of sand kicking and I wrote this chapter that made no sense whatsoever. And then I just left it there and thought I wasn't going to write about that. And then there was actually a Chinese writer who wrote a novel, a fictionalized version of the affair that was very thinly disguised and ended up being a court case in China of defamation. And so she had gone overboard so much with making up all sorts of details that were worse than probably what really happened. That then, you know, that if I could tell a truer version than that, that was actually going to redeem my family in some ways.
Well, just to conclude, you were able before she died to show your grandmother the book, and you told a wonderful story about her reaction to that.
Yeah, it was very typically her. I mean, I think she had claimed to be writing her own version, so I never showed her mine because she wouldn't show me her version of the book. But I don't know if she believed me after all of the years it took me to write it that I was actually going to finish it, because in many ways it really is her book. And so I feel incredibly blessed that I was able to give it to her just a few weeks before she passed away. And she said, "I knew you could do it. And now you have time to have children. Where are my great-grandchildren?"
Thank you, Sasha Suling Wellen. I want to give everybody in the audience now an opportunity to...
Hello, Michael.
Hi.
I wanted to ask you, have you seen the movie The Departed?
Yeah.
And do you think that was really Whitey Bulger leaving the movie in San Diego?
Oh, I don't know. The movie The Departed depicts organized crime in Boston, mainly in South Boston, it deals with all the stuff I wrote about in All Souls and Easter Rising, except it focuses on the halls of power, the relationship between Whitey Bulger, the head of organized crime in Southie, the head of the Irish Mafia, and a drug lord and murderer, his relationship with agents in the FBI. Because in recent years, it came out that all the years that he was controlling the neighborhood and maintaining a code of silence, he was in fact an informant with the FBI. He was actually protected by agents of the FBI and was allowed to do as he likes in our neighborhood in exchange for being an informant. And the movie The Departed, Scorsese's new movie, takes place in that whole culture. It's the actual story is based on a Japanese film, and I forget the name of, and it's he set it in the culture of South Boston and in Boston. I never pay attention to the whole Whitey Bulger, like, where's Whitey kind of debate, because it's like, you know, Elvis sightings, you know, at this point. So and it's also the more I was able to get into this whole truth-telling process, the less significant he's become to me. And a lot of people really focus on kind of the titillating gangster story aspects of this stuff, and I've moved so far away from all of that, those aspects of it, because for me it's more about, you know, how do kids grow up in this culture? How do kids in general grow up in not just South Boston, but in a culture of lies and of hidden truths, however you want to put it. So that's been my focus. And, you know, whatever happens to Whitey, you know, I mean, I don't know if he's even alive, who knows, but that's not really as important to me as the whole question of how do we raise kids in a culture that's more truthful.
And what I find fascinating about that comment, Michael, is that the process of uncovering these secrets and being more truthful disempowers a character like a Whitey, as mm-hmm. you just said, right?
Yeah.
He recedes
right,
in right. that story.
Right. It's the same thing with, you know, with any perpetrator, really. Perpetrators, I mean, it's important to, you know, for there to be justice and for people, for the law enforcement and for the courts to prosecute. But for the mental health and the emotional health of victims of crime and violence, it's much bigger than anything that the courts and law enforcement can do. It's really, there's much more healing to be had in the truth-telling aspects.
Thank you. There was another question, I think, right there.
Yeah, Michael also. Just a quick comment first. I think it's interesting in your story of Southie, and for other people to realize as well, that not only was the society closed and socially isolated, but that's really reinforced by the fact that it's geographically isolated.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
even
right.
within Boston, I don't
yeah.
know if people realize it's a little peninsula
yeah.
that you can't get to unless you know how to get to it, quite frankly. I mean, it's...
Right.
You know, it's not downtown Boston. It's not, you know, five blocks down the road and two blocks left. It's, you know, it's its own little physical enclave.
Yeah.
As well as being a social enclave.
And Boston neighborhoods in general are set up like that, too, around the center rather than being on a grid. They're kind of all kind of, but Southie would be the most, you know, it's inaccessible
right.
in every way. And
sure.
And the only way in and out was... over these bridges that, and a lot of Easter Rising is about crossing that bridge when people just wouldn't cross that bridge.
So what kind of response did you get back home when you were going over to Dorchester to relate experiences and help people
mm-hmm.
who accepted the fact that ghettos and poverty bred violence and oppression, you know, something that was never admitted in your own neighborhood.
Right.
And you said you had to reach out to neighborhoods of other cultures to even interact with people who had similar experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how was it when, you know, I mean, going to Dorchester just wasn't something a kid from Southie did.
Right,
and
I was in the local press a lot around the work that I was doing, the anti-violence work I was doing in the city. And it was all well and good when I was working with other people's tragedies and other people's violence and crime, but then when I started to tell my story and the fact that this stuff happened in Southie, and not just to my family, but to, you know, so many neighbors. In this period, we lost so many young people throughout the the 70s and 80s. And then the 90s, there was a huge heroin and suicide epidemic, which I think is connected to the earlier period, the earlier gangster period, and the code of silence. So when I started to tell my story, then there was just people were uneasy with it, and I didn't get any kind of response. When I started bringing the activism home to South Boston and bringing survivors of homicide and the drug trade from throughout the city, bringing them to South Boston to help organize like a vigil. We did a vigil on All Souls Day. That's why the first book's called All Souls, to remember all those who died too young. And we kept it innocuous like that, just to remember all those who died too young. And we know how young people die. They die from things that nobody in Southie wanted to talk about. Or in the general culture, people have a hard time talking about a lot of those issues. You know, and there's a stigma associated with all of that, whether it's murder, suicide, drugs. And so when we first did this vigil, I figured about 10 people would come. But the place was mobbed. People were just waiting for someone to tell the truth. And then, you know, they all came out, everybody named their child who had been killed in the neighborhood or who had overdosed in the neighborhood. And so all it took was just, you know, a few people willing to get up there and say the names of their loved ones who died too young. And it brought, you know, I mean, the lines were around the block.
I want to say something, and sure. I also want to ask you something. When I hear you describe all these things, it brings back some of the hate mail I get with my columns, because I'm also a columnist. When I talk about the Hispanic community and they say, why do you have to be Hispanic Americans? Why do they have to be hyphenated Americans? Why can't everybody be American? Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I see and that you describe is that with African Americans and Hispanic Americans, there is a lot of pride in their cultural mm-hmm. heritage, so much so that we have national organizations that are always either doing research or looking for ways to identify the problems that they have in their communities. Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like in your neighborhood, as an Irish-American community, they were in denial. They wanted to not have anything to do with their cultural heritage, right, and were trying to adapt. I mean, is there a contradiction in this country about people wanting to all be Americans and denying their cultural heritage? And isn't that something that can hurt you? I mean, is there a way to reconcile being a Chinese American, Irish American, mm-hmm. in my case, Mexican American or Hispanic American, and want to be part of mainstream and just be this? After all, this is a country of immigrants.
Right.
I don't know. Can I get your comments on that, both of you?
Well, when you mentioned earlier, in your introduction, he referred to you as an immigrant success story. You know, this, and that's the history of America. America is an immigrant success story.
And that's the story we're allowed to tell, I think.
Right.
But what we do, I mean, at least I know that when people ask me about giving advice, which happens a lot of times, well, you know, what advice do you give to the Hispanic community, to young people? One of my main things is, be proud of who you are. Be proud of your cultural heritage. I think one thing that happens with Hispanic Americans is that geographically, I mean, they're just south of the border in all the countries that they come from, whether it be South America or Central America or the Caribbean, mm-hmm. and they're very close to there, so they continue to hold on to their language mm-hmm. and their traditions and their cultural heritage, and they're very proud of them. And I'm sure that in the Irish community, Chinese community, they want to just leave everything behind, start new, and say, okay, I'm just plain American. But the reality is that no one really is just plain
Absolutely.
American.
Yeah.
I mean, you can be proud of your flag, an American flag, and your American passport, and you are an American. But when the minute that you start denying your cultural heritage or wanting to stay away from it, you have problems like that you had in your area and that you had as a young as a teenager, where you didn't want to have anything to do with
right.
Ireland.
And that loss of identity is dangerous.
It is, isn't it? I think it's better if we all in this country just celebrate our heritage, our cultural heritage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's really difficult when and where. You know, I learned that sort of historical circumstances, even geographic circumstance in the United States within Asian American communities have really strong impacts. So, for example, my grandmother tried really, really hard her life to assimilate to the point that one of the things that's very hard for me to write in the book is that she also assimilated a kind of white racism towards other immigrant groups, even though she herself had experienced this kind of discrimination because she was trying so hard to fit in. And, you know, it took me to go back through the archives of newspapers to figure out that actually the moment that she arrived in Cleveland as one of, you know, in her story, one of the only Chinese in the city, that actually it was at a moment in American history of incredible police antagonism towards Chinese-American communities because they were seeing, were claiming that there was this kind of clannish Tong wars that were going on. And so there had been, months before she arrived, a huge crackdown in Boston on the Chinese community where they arrested and deported hundreds, and then again in New York, and then actually I think it was just a week or 2 weeks after she arrived in Cleveland, 600 Chinese were arrested, men, women, children, and their community was razed because it was, you know, there was a murder that had happened and it was claimed that someone in the whole community was to blame. So, you know, that really told me why, at that moment of her very arrival, why she tried so hard to assimilate. And then, you know, they were one of two Chinese families in Indianapolis in the Midwest when there was very little community to support them. And so, you know, that was World War II. People thought they were Japanese. And so, you know, I can really imagine, you know, I really began to appreciate, you know, I was very sad about, you know, my mother didn't grow up speaking Chinese, I didn't, you know, that wasn't this kind of community, but the reasons why they had tried so hard, you know, it really hit me in a whole new way.
Do we have another question from the audience? We have probably time for one or two more. Cheryl?
I wanted to say first that I really, really enjoyed all three stories, and I was really touched by all of them. And I wanted to ask Michael, do you think that your activism in some way has changed South Boston in your area?
In the beginning, when we first started doing these vigils and people were coming out and telling the truth, there was this opportunity for the neighborhood to transform and to be, you know, a healthy community made up of, you know, the people that were from there as well as some of the new people that were moving into the neighborhood. And a culturally diverse neighborhood. There was a lot of integration happening in the housing developments there. And right at the same time that there was a lot of hope for real change toward, you know, for the better, the neighborhood was began the process of gentrification, and with that, a kind of new erasure of its history and of the people that lived there before. The neighborhood's really unaffordable now. It's really gentrified, really trendy, real estate hotspot, and it's unaffordable. I couldn't afford to live there.
Thanks to you. Yeah.
No, it's not. No, it's real estate agents have the real estate agents don't like anything that I do. So because I mean, I wrote a piece actually in praise of The Departed, the movie The Departed, because I thought Scorsese got it right by creating in the theater the suffocation that I felt as a kid growing up under that type of tyranny of organized crime and law enforcement working together. And real estate agents came out with letters to the editor and just were attacking me for, and they didn't identify themselves as real estate agents, but they didn't like that image of the neighborhood. This was, you know, this is a great place to move and to raise children, and it is. I mean, it's, you know, I never said that it was a bad place, but we need to tell the whole truth. So the neighborhood's transformed, but more just through gentrification, it's being completely erased. For all the best and worst aspects of the community are being erased at this time. One of the stories I tell in Easter Rising is when I first went to Ireland in the mid-80s, at a time when Ireland was really economically deprived place and you know, one of the poorest economies in Europe, and very different from now. The first question that I received from people was, is it true that you're all racist, in other words, Irish-American. So Irish people wanted to know, is it true what we hear about Irish-American racism? And that just floored me, because I figured that I wanted nothing to do with Irish people in general, and I thought they were all racist. So I was blown away that people in Ireland were deeply ashamed of what they had heard about Irish-American conflicts with African-Americans in places in Boston, in New York, and so forth. I was blown away by that they were aware of that and that they were ashamed by it. And the reason for that is because they were so in touch with their history at that point, and they were still engaged in struggle. And this was relatives close to the border in the north, where as Catholics, as descendants of the indigenous colonized population, they identified more with the African-American struggle than with the Irish American struggle, than what they identified more with the African American struggle than what they had heard about the Irish American struggle, and all of the civil rights movement in the north of Ireland was based on the African American civil rights movement here, and that all blew me away to start to learn that history. But in recent years, now with what's called the Celtic Tiger and Ireland's economic boom, there's been for the first time immigration to Ireland, and with that, it has come, just shopping addictions like you've never seen, and erasing of their history and forgetting that they were once not white, not considered white. And with that, you get a lot of racist attacks against new groups coming in. Now, you'll get it more in the South, where people aren't engaged in the struggle that people in the North are still engaged in. Being in the North, there's still a British colony, and Catholics are second-class citizens in the North. The descendants of the indigenous people are second-class citizens, so they're much more aware up there of their history because they're living it. In the South, where there's economic prosperity, people are forgetting their history, and as a result, Nigerians will get stabbed in Dublin.
Sasha, I just want to ask you, I mean, in China, and we'll wrap up with this question, there's this tremendous economic boom as well, and it's bringing internal immigration. Is there anything there that your own story and these stories we've heard might apply to the Chinese experience right now?
To back up a little bit to the gentleman's question, I mean, I think just to add to what others have said is that history really matters, that these movements of people, whether they're internal or transnational, have deep, historical roots of colonialism, of different political moments. What's happening in China now is, the miracle of capitalism hitting China is actually leading to incredible economic stratification, which is really quite severe when you look at the difference. What we see on the news is often of the urban centers and the kind of poverty that is, persistent and getting worse, arguably, because of the kind of toxic dumping in the factories that produce all of the goods that we make that are being done in the countryside, is a continuation of the process, I think, that is a part of capitalism that is hidden often from our stories of the Chinese economy right now as a roaring success.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been a terrific discussion. I appreciate the attention in the audience. Thank you, Maria Elena Salinas. Michael Patrick McDonald, Sasha Suling Welland, thank you for coming. I want to thank the organizers of the Miami Book Fair for inviting us to be here. My name is Chris Keneally. For more information about what we do, go to www.beyondthebook.com. Thank you again.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. With conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists, Beyond the Book is the premier resource for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.